once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest author, Laura Meyer, Esquire. Her book, Guided by Grace, A Catholic Journey Through Wills, Trusts, and Estate Planning, available through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. Welcome, Laura. Great to have you on the program. People would have seen you on with Jim and Joy. Talking about this. Now, this isn't the first book you've written. This is, what, maybe number three, but this is kind of the first Catholic-oriented book?
It is. So my previous two books were very helpful for families, finances, estate planning, secular in nature. So Guided by Grace is the first book I've done that really overtly intersects faith with estate planning.
Well, let me ask you this. Guided by Grace, okay, A Catholic Journey Through Wills, Trusts, and Estate Planning. What makes it Catholic?
So I was surprised when I dived into our Catholic faith teachings that we have so many specific teachings on topics that fall within estate planning. And so I did a deep dive into the Catechism, also the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops publications, the Bible. And in there, I found all the teachings that we needed to really intersect our faith when we make these huge decisions for our family.
Let me ask you, you hear the word estate and you think, okay, so this is for millionaires and people with lots and lots of money. So the average person's wondering, why are we talking about this on this program?
Well, so everybody has an estate to some degree. So some people might need more planning than others. But what most people don't realize, whether you have a little or a lot, if you don't do planning, your state that you live in is right. going to step in and do planning for you. And I always say, as a spoiler alert, you are not going to like it. It's going to involve, if you have minor children, they can be placed in temporary foster care, and then a judge has to choose a guardian. All of your money would have to go through a long and expensive court process called probate. Your medical decisions might not be made the way you want, and you're definitely not going to have your final act be going out on a good note when your family is thrown into court.
Right. Well, the one that really struck me, I thought was great, was when you said, you know, the default plan. Most people refer to estate planning as making a will. I always pose the question to families, and I'll ask you a question now, too. What percentage of adults do you think have an estate plan? I usually get guesses like 5%, 20%, or 10%. But the answer is?
100%.
How is that true?
Because everyone, you know, all of the EWTN family watching right now, everybody has an estate plan. Because if you haven't done it yourself, the state will step in with their default plan for your family.
And that's the thing you're not going to be particularly happy about, which you go through with some of the ramifications, things like probate court and stuff like that. That reminds me of Bleak House from Dickens, when you read about probate court, this terrible lawsuit that goes on and on and on in that particular episode, which was reflective, actually, of Dickens' life. But you talk about in the very beginning, you personalizing, you talk about your young son, Andrew, and the idea of being out of control. What did that have to do with writing this book?
Well, I use that story of when we couldn't find our son when he had been lost that day. He was 3 years old. When we couldn't find him, where, you know, you call first responders, the police come, you call your neighbors, you call your friends. Everyone wants to help you. But ultimately, you do find yourself in situations beyond anyone's control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wrote in the book about how I just kind of hung my head at the top of that bridge after searching for him for 40 minutes along with police and friends. And I just prayed, because I think anyone, you know, anyone at home getting a diagnosis, losing a loved one, anyone can relate to that despair you feel. But ultimately, it is the presence of God that we long for most in our times of need, and it is our true help.
Well, you're lucky. Back in the day, there were actually, and I think they still are, but we just don't hear about them, Good Samaritans who actually helped your son come back, right?
I had never seen so many elderly people in my neighborhood running that day to help us find our son. It was truly touching, and thankfully he was safe and sound. He had just wandered off.
You say it's ultimately the presence of God that we long for most during our greatest times of need. You say, yet many of us who take the time to create a plan to protect ourselves and loved ones during medical crises or death tend to consider only the legal, practical considerations, like those who oversee our affairs or what age our children should receive their inheritance. Mm-hmm. You view it as a secular transaction. So how do we transcend that in your mind?
So what I suggest and what I write about in the book is when you go to meet with your lawyer, which everybody should find out what level of planning do I need. And you need to address the legal and the practical. And you know, only 30% of families even do that, right? Most, 70% do nothing, and they rely on the state. But when you go to have those conversations, don't just treat it as a secular task. You want to ask, what does my faith teach me about these decisions I should be making, and how can I truly ensure that God's best will be brought into my life, my suffering, my death, into, you know, being there for my family, all of that.
You say we don't ask questions like, how does God intend for the assets to be passed on? What would you praying about it lead you to decide different than saying, well, I want to make sure, you know, if I go, my husband and the kids are taken care of. That seems pretty straightforward. Do I need the Holy Spirit to lead me in that way?
Absolutely, right? We want the Holy Spirit to lead us in everything. And it's, you know, the Catechism says, as good stewards, you know, we're responsible for all the gifts God's given us, and that our first obligation is to our own family. Right. So it's good to want to take care of our spouse and kids, but we're also told that after we meet our family's needs, that we are called to reserve, quote, the better part of that for the greater good. And so that's when the decision making really needs to come in, where we need to think beyond just our own family, but also our Christian family and our human family.
So is that where you're looking for the insight, is to determining what the greater good might be that God is calling you?
Yeah,
and so maybe some of your assets to?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that was eye-opening to me is that in our Catholic faith teachings, we are not called to give 10%. That was the old rule. We're actually, our rule is according to our means. And there's actually a four-part test to determine what does that mean for my own family. So we ask questions like, is it proportional? Like, am I giving, what I'm giving, is it proportional to what I actually have? And then the second is, which we're talking about, is it prayerful? Meaning, have I asked God where to leave my assets during my lifetime as well? And then the third is it planned? Which means we should actively be planning each month, regularly giving, and then in our estate plans. And then the last one would be, which no one likes, is it sacrificial? Meaning, that's truly when you're willing to give something up that you might even need to somebody else who needs it more, trusting that God is going to still take care of our family.
Now, is it your experience that at least in when people are doing that aspect of giving, that in the old days, kind of what they would say maybe with the World War II generation, maybe the early boomers, they would kind of give it to organizations and things and trust the organization to do the right thing.
Right.
And that younger people tend to be a little more skeptical, maybe or a little more interested in being involved exactly or earmarking what exactly you're going to use what I'm giving you for.
Yeah, and so we see that with giving. And even donors who are more seasoned in life now, they want to make sure that the money that they donate, that organization is also a good steward of the assets. And so fortunately, there is a lot of information now online. Before you give to an organization, you can see how much is going towards the cause, what is it going towards. And then our younger donors, what we find is they like to be philanthropists all over the place. They like to give a little here, there. But that's where I really love the church's teachings on making it prayerful, where, you know, maybe just pick a few causes where you can impact that, and God will speak to someone else on other causes as well.
Where your treasures are, that's where your heart is, right?
Absolutely.
So you should kind of, your heart is, maybe move your treasures there. You say money can end up unnecessarily go to the government or get taken by ill-intentioned third parties, and you're talking about the whole idea of probate. But of course, if I have a will, it doesn't go to probate, does it?
You know, that's actually a big myth, and everyone, we're always told, get a will, but a will actually does not avoid a court process when you die. It simply instructs a judge how you want your assets to be distributed. So instead, if you have what's called a living trust, that's really a way for you to avoid that court process. It's very similar to a will, because it says, this is who I am, this is who I love, this is where I want my money to go when I die, and who I trust to oversee my affairs. But a trust is private, and it can be administered efficiently between the family, the beneficiaries, the lawyer, without having to go through court.
Is that expensive to do?
It's a fraction of the cost, typically, of probate. And I know I'm in a state, you know, California, California, so everything is top dollar there. Our probate is extremely expensive. We pay the taxes when we're living, and we pay them when we go. So probate can be extremely expensive.
You have like a cheat sheet in here. It kind of gives a sense of like 5% or whatever percentage.
Yeah, so typically if you go online and there's online probate calculators, you can find the one in your state and find out, you know, how much it would actually cost you. But in California, it starts out at 8% of your estate, and it'll slide down as your estate, you know, rises in value. So it's still, I use a 5% figure in the book just to give people an idea. In California, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, and certainly setting up your own estate plan will be a fraction of that.
Right, certainly, especially with the reasonably inflated real estate.
Yes, in California, yes.
California.
You could get a nice small shack for $2 million.
Right, exactly. So it's not, you say this avoids, hopefully, the idea of many families end up fighting, in some cases become completely torn apart because it's unclear what supposed to be happening.
Right, and you know, if you've traveled even with your kids, it's hard enough to agree on what everybody wants for dinner. Imagine having no game plan on who's in charge of mom and dad's medical decisions, who's in charge of cleaning out the home, who's in charge of selling it and distributing assets. And so the process itself, when we fail to plan, can pit good families, really good families, against each other and cause a lot of dissension. And really planning prayerfully and addressing all this while we have the opportunity can severely mitigate that from happening.
And certainly for younger families, you make the point about the idea in a divorce or a death, you're dealing with the fact of who your minor children would be raised by. And I think one of the things you talk about, I thought it was interesting, I had never really thought about it this way, that people would think that godparents have a responsibility to raise your kids or something, which is obviously not true.
It's not true, yes. So the Catholic Church also does not expect that. Mm-hmm. And then also the state does not use that as a default guardian. And so really it's the grandparents that the state looks to first, typically in a probate proceeding for minor children who need a guardian. But that's why we encourage parents, don't leave any of that to chance. They just need to name permanent guardians who can raise their kids if something happens to them.
Well, is it harder these days, in your experience, because of the, let's say, plethora of divorces that are out there and the idea that you end up with broken families or separated families who have multiple grandparents, let alone, you know, multiple quote-unquote parents?
Yeah, and certainly family dynamics play into all of that, and there's lots of different families. They look differently these days. Mm-hmm. And so who a judge might think is the best fit for your family might not be what you think. And I was...
Especially spiritually.
Well, exactly.
If you want somebody raised in the faith or something.
Right, and in the catechism, you know, when I did the research, it talks about what type of home God wants children raised in. And, you know, when I went to do guardians myself the first time, my husband and I thought about things like, well, who has the best zip code and, you know, who will get them in the best schools? You know, who's the best looking? No, we didn't consider that. But, you know, you think about these worldly things.
Right.
But when you go to the catechism and our biblical teachings, God's not concerned about that. He's more concerned about our children being raised in a loving home. Where they're respected as persons of God. He is deeply concerned with their spiritual education. He wants us to raise our children educated in the faith. And then the third priority the catechism lays out is that he wants children protected from the decay of the world. And I thought, what a good word choice when we think about what our kids are battling right now between all the stuff they see online and with friends and just the culture. And so when you look to our faith teachings, it will give parents clarity when they ask those tough questions about who would make a good guardian. We don't need to rely on our own priorities, and those things are important, the practical stuff, but we can rely on what God says is a priority.
Right. And so I'll show you the legal and practical steps you can take to protect yourself and your loved ones during a medical crisis or death. You go on to say you'll be getting both the plain glass and the stained glass version of creating a plan for your family. What's the difference between those two?
A plain glass would be what most people do, if they even do it at all, which is I meet with a lawyer, I do the default, you know, who should get my money? Okay, I check a box on a medical form, I stuff my estate plan in a drawer and I stop thinking about it. A stained glass version is where you really pray about it. You really get up to speed and research and understand our faith's teachings mm-hmm. on these topics and bring that into your decision making, because that's how you can truly have a plan that's going to protect yourself and your loved ones during their greatest times of need.
You say, well, there are a lot of things the state will do for you that you won't like. There's also a lot of things, this is in case you die, whatever, you know, and things they won't do for you, which is even worse. What's examples of things they won't do for you?
So what they're not going to do for you is help you prayerfully decide where to leave your money and in what way. They're not going to consider our medical standard of care as Catholics. They're going to apply the world's standard of care, which is a much
pretty
lower
shaky these days,
standard.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, very, especially in some of the states, depending mm-hmm. on where people live. And what they're not going to do is they're not going to preserve your legacy. They're not going to make sure that you've taken, you know, time to capture your values on, you know, what we call a legacy interview where you talk to your loved ones. They're not going to take time to make sure all those charities that you were involved with in your parish, that they're taken care of. They're not going to do any of that.
Yeah, you mentioned in some particular state law, I don't know if it's California, if parents become incapacitated or die, their minor children can be placed in temporary foster care and a judge will have to decide who should raise them, unless the parents have legally named temporary or permanent legal guardians. So even if you're thinking, well, the grandparents might be the right people, they may not be temporarily where they end up.
Right, so the kids would have to go through a whole process when there's not a plan in place. And sometimes, you know, this happened to a family in San Diego where the husband and wife were killed in a car accident, and instead of immediately going to family in the area, first responders just didn't even know how to get in touch with them. There was a practical, logistical issue there and barrier, and those kids were instead placed in the care of strangers when they really should mm-hmm. have been placed with family. What parents need to understand is that when you don't have a plan in place and you haven't legally authorized other mm-hmm. people to keep your children, the state, you know, needs to look out for the children as well. Your children then become a liability to the state, and they need to make sure they have care.
In Chapter 3, short-term care plan, you say, when parents come to my office for a first meeting, ask them a single question: what will happen today to your kids if you don't make it home from this meeting? They must love that question.
Yeah, they usually get really nervous and they start texting someone, like, just in case. But yeah, you know, a lot of times we hear about naming guardians and estate plans and the hypothetical, but when we really think about it, and everyone, you know, in our EWTN family should be thinking about this, is if this was it today, mm-hmm. could you hand over a plan to your family and say, don't worry, all is well, I've taken care of everything, and this is how it works. And most of us don't have that level of confidence. So for everybody, it's not only time to revisit your estate plan, but time to revisit the decisions you made in it now that, you know, you really can invoke our Catholic faith teachings.
So let me ask you, how early should somebody decide? As a single person, do I need one? Is it when I get married? Is it when I have kids? Or how does that work?
And those are all life milestones that are going to affect what level of planning you need. But to give you an example, the day our son turned 18, he had to get some form of estate planning, because once he was 18, if he got sick, we were not going to be authorized anymore to make his medical decisions. He's a legal adult. Also with finances, we wouldn't be allowed to access his bank accounts to help him. So he needed some level of planning even as a young adult. Certainly once you have dependents, a spouse, children, anyone who's depending on you, you need to make sure you have a plan so that they're taken care of. Mm-hmm. So that would be a higher level of planning, right. Especially if you're going to face probate and you do have right. assets like a home. You definitely need some level of planning.
Well, you describe it as a lawsuit you file against yourself. How so?
Yeah. Well, that's what probate court is, because you're basically saying, rather than me taking care of this, I'm going to have my family go through a long and expensive court process when I die that's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars, which, by the way, is going to get paid out of what you worked so hard for during your lifetime to pay. So it is like suing yourself in a way, in having your family part of a litigation.
So is procrastination the number one reason people don't do this?
Absolutely. Okay. Procrastination, second to that would be fear. It's not fun to think about this stuff.
I was going to ask you, is that a big part where people just don't like to think about that?
Yeah, and they might not be in agreement with their spouse on how decisions should be made, especially if they have a blended family. That can get tricky. How are you treating the children you had together versus children that came into the marriage? So there's lots of different barriers. But remember, when you hesitate to do this and you feel that it's overwhelming, imagine how much harder it's going to be for your family to then sort that out with a judge. Right. It's so much easier if we do that today.
And obviously people could be disappointed because, like you said, they might have planned on this for their kids or for their grandkids or even for EW Chan or some other wonderful organization, for the common good, as you refer to it in here, and then have that being eaten up by these court costs, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of us would much rather write a $10,000 check to EWTN when we die than having that go to the state. I know I personally would.
Right.
So when you do your planning, you get to, it's like a white canvas board. Mm-hmm. You get to map out very prayerfully where your assets should go and to think about how they can also benefit the greater good and spare your family from chaos in court.
You also talk about obligations not only for the common good, but also the idea that you got to pay your bills.
Yes, yes. And that goes back to, you know, as good stewards, you know, as we know, everything we have comes from God, and He's trusting us to use it in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. And so it is good to take care of our family. Mm-hmm. It is good to provide for our family. And in fact, we even have teachings saying that if our parents are elderly and they are sick and they don't have money, we're actually responsible to the extent we can to help them in a material way as well. And so all
of legally responsible, or are we morally?
Morally,
responsible?
So you're not legally responsible to provide for your parents.
The Ten Commandments tell
but
us we're
yes,
supposed to
under
be
the
doing
fourth
that.
Commandment, we are obligated to help our parents in their time of need.
Now, Chapter 9, passing money to your children. You had a woman come in and said, "I'm here because I never want to burden my son with money," and you said that sounds like a great problem to have. But she had a reason behind it, right?
She did. This was a wonderful young woman. She had received an inheritance when she was 18 years old, and it didn't come with any restrictions or protections. It was a blank check. And rather than going on to college, getting a job, building her future like everybody else in, you know, her peer group did, it actually took her off track. And, you know, she traveled a lot. Those are good experiences, of course, but she wasn't furthering her future. Mm-hmm. And the party ended when she said, as she described, she ended up unexpectedly pregnant. Mm-hmm. And that's when reality sort of hit about the choices she made. And so she came in with that baby and said, "I have a life insurance policy, and I want to make sure that when I go, it would be structured in a way that would benefit my son and not be free reign." And sadly, all of that inheritance she had gotten, which was $500,000, was completely gone.
Okay.
She was starting from scratch.
And you also make the point of noting for people to know when they're doing these kind of structured things for the kids, the brain development doesn't stop until 25.
I feel like our brains are all still developing.
I think you go into 30 these days at least. One thing I wanted to touch on, obviously, from my own perspective, is something that we kind of looked at as the special needs trust.
Yes. Yeah.
Explain what that is.
So for all of our EWTN family out there, if you have a child with special needs, you need to pass your money in a unique way so that your child can get the support that they need and receive their inheritance from their parents. But in a way that's not going to disqualify them from receiving the government benefits that they're also entitled to. So every parent who has a child with special needs should meet with a lawyer, explain the situation, and a special needs trust attorney is going to be able to help you structure it in a way where your child can really have a beautiful life, even if they live beyond you, and get the care they need, and then also get the public benefits.
You also mentioned some of the mistakes people used to make. What would those be as far as with special needs children, kind of disinheriting them or doing something
that? Used to be the way that families would do it is they'd say, well, to get government benefits, they're not allowed to have, you know, more than $2,000 in their name. So therefore, I won't leave my child money. I'll leave it to my other child and trust them to just give it to my child who has a disability. But that technique you know, not only does the money not get earmarked for the child who needs it, but then too, if something happens in the other child's life, like they get divorced or there's a creditor, or they just choose not to use it all, you can't really ensure that it's going to go to your child with special needs. So that's where a special needs trust comes in, because it's kind of the best of both worlds, and it gives parents so much peace of mind.
Chapter 16, what your medical directive should include, because we've heard about advanced health directives, things related to organ donation. And one of the things that struck me here, you talked about the HIPAA authorization. Explain where that's an issue for people.
So under federal law, our medical information is all private, right? I can't call up your doctor, you can't call up mine. But if you're a family member and your loved one's in the hospital, that still applies unless you have signed what's called a HIPAA authorization. That's where you list on a form people that you are authorizing to receive your confidential healthcare information so that they would know what's going on in an emergency.
Right, and that sometimes people will see that actually when they go see the doctor.
They'll be on the HIPAA form. The information.
Okay. Yes. Well, what's been the response to your book so far?
You know, I think it's a few people have admitted almost like a confession that they have some work to do on their own estate plan.
So you're laying a lot of guilt on Catholics,
I
see.
Okay. Catholic guilt, it works. No, but you know, the response has been wonderful, because I think what's come out of it, and even for myself from writing it, is it didn't just end with what I wanted to do in my death. It actually made me rethink the role that faith is playing in my life today and the legacy that we're creating. So I hope for everybody watching, they can read it, take it to heart, pray about it, and truly live and die in peace.
There. Amen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Laura Meyer, Esquire, her book Guided by Grace, A Catholic Journey Through Wills, Trusts, and Estate Planning. Their website is guidedbygraceplanning.com. The book's available through our EWTN religious catalog. A lot of interesting information. Check it out, and check us out next time right here on EWTN's Bookmark. Thanks for joining us.